WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. President Clinton is probably in no laughing mood right now, but my guest Jim Morris isn't going to let that stop him from lampooning the president. Morris is a political satirist and impressionist who started his career at about the same time President Reagan took office. Morris worked up such a convincing portrayal of Reagan, he took his act to Washington and held mock press conferences. When Reagan left office, Morris went on to become George Bush. Now he's doing Bill Clinton. He's performed at the White House and Washington correspondence dinners, not to mention comedy clubs around the country. I asked Jim Morris to be Bill Clinton for us and tell us what he's been most unprepared for as president.
I just have to say that I wasn't prepared for the onslaught of the type of scrutiny that I'd be coming under as president of the United States. I believe that George Stephanopoulos did a wonderful job, but we needed to make a change there. Now, there's been speculation that I've somehow banished George or sent him away, but he's actually nearby. He's taken over as assistant manager, trainee at the McDonald's here in Washington, D.C., so I see him two, three, even four times a day. He can continue to serve this administration, albeit in a different capacity. A question may be raised by you or somebody else in the press, did I use my influence to get him that job? Well, let me just say, I wouldn't be surprised if the president doesn't get a few extra French fries here and there. God bless you for asking that. But I'm enjoying my time here in the Oval Office.
Was the $200 haircut worth the money, and would you recommend the stylist to other men?
Let me just say, I've learned to develop a sense of humor about things like that. For instance, I just flew in from L.A., and boy, is my hair short. You know, jokes like that. But, and so's my temper. I can't believe people in you, like you in the press would, you know, still quiz me on something like that. You know, it's been an awful hardship on me since Floyd the Barber moved to Mount Pilot. I don't know what else to tell you.
No, I understand we're privileged to have former President George Bush in the room as well. President Bush, how do you think President Clinton is doing?
How do I think President Clinton's doing? Well, certainly not going to, you're not going to hear me, no sour grapes here, no bitterness here. You're not going to hear me call my opponent in the last campaign there a failed, philandering, whoremongering, hillbilly, saxophone-sucking former governor of a small southern state. You're not going to hear it from me. I support him. My sleeves are rolled up. My hand is extended to him. But my middle finger's starting to twitch. I tell you that. But yeah, I think, can I be candid with you?
Go ahead.
I think what we're going to see is nothing more than Clinton economics, I call it Elvis economics, a reckless policy of excessive spending that causes the government to get fatter and fatter until one day the economy just falls off the toilet and dies. That's Elvis economics. I don't know what else to tell you, you know, but there's no bitterness here. I felt I deserved to be reelected. We had a wonderful first term. Just look at the wreckage. Record.
No, I think you had it right the first time, George.
Hey, nobody's talking to you. I'm very happy down in Houston there with Barbara. We're in the grandkid business. We're shipping them over the border in vans. Just kidding.
No, I think that really points up his attitude.
Now, hold on. Now, you remember the convention in Houston when my grandson George P. stood up there and shouted, Viva Bush? Remember that?
Of course I do. Actually, I didn't watch it, but what's your point?
Well, Viva is Spanish for paper towel. And I think what George P. was trying to say was that this campaign was going to be the quicker picker-upper, but it didn't work out that way. But I'll tell you this, I was the one who was tested. I deserved to be reelected. I was the one who'd been through the fire. I was the one who'd been through the desert on a horse with no name.
Listen to this guy over here, and I'm sure it feels good to be out of the rain, too.
Jim Morris, I'm going to call on you. what's it been like for you to have a new president in the White House who you really have to get down, both the voice, the manner, but you also have to get down their take on things and have your take on their take.
Right. It's always a work in progress. I mean, I'm even adding layers to Reagan's, you know, I saw him at the Kings games there in L.A. On TV. I saw him sitting there with Nancy, and he looked a little, you know, so that even that gives me more information. What? No. Nancy, what's going on here? What? Look at the hockey puck. Oh, that's right. We're at a Don Rickles show. Where's the hockey puck? No. See, so one day I'll do a one-man show with all these guys together. You know, I'll look back. But with Bill Clinton, here's a guy who speaks in complete sentences, and that makes it more difficult than doing George Bush. It can start to say something of that particular nature. No, we've got problems over there, and furthermore, I know that we did whatever Bosnia Herzegovina got a DeVita. You know, I mean, it was more fun doing Bush because we all knew about his quirks and eccentricities, and with Clinton, it takes the audience more time to get to know the guy. I mean, presidents tend to get funnier over time, whether it's a crisis or the pressures of the job. You know, in the past few months, there's been a lot to laugh at with Clinton.
Do you change your material depending on whether you're performing for a Democratic or Republican audience?
No, I don't. No, I mean, you know, I remember when I performed for President Bush on a few occasions. I was very nervous, but not, you know, because I was performing for the president. It was more like I was nervous about whether I was going to pull any punches and not go at him with, you know, go for the jugular. And I said, well, what the hell? You know, you only go around once. And I hit him with the hardest hitting material I had. And it was a success. That's what I do. I don't need to water it down for anybody. And certainly now with Clinton, I try not to take the cheap shots, you know. A cheap shot, here's an example of a cheap shot.
Yeah.
You know, on the Supreme Court nominee, we'll probably be hearing about, you know, by the end of the week. Here's a joke that I probably shouldn't do and won't, except for you and your listeners.
Lucky us. Go ahead.
In terms of a nominee for Supreme Court, there are many ways that this administration could go. One, we could go through a lengthy and time-consuming search for someone who represents the very best ideals of justice and fairness and would bring an experienced sense of fairness to the Supreme Court. Or we could just put another chick in there, you know, someone for Sandy O'Connor to swap recipes with. See, there's an example of a sexist joke. And
this is one you're not going to tell, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, might pepper the act with a couple of references, but that's about it, because it's too easy, it's too cheap. It's like Jimmy Carter with the smile or with the rabbit or Jerry Ford stumbling down the stairs. I mean, once you do the joke, then what? You know. So I'm fascinated by the news and politicians and why people would even get into a life like that. And so really, I try to do what an editorial cartoonist might do, and that is take the news of the day and put a caption, you know, on the bottom of the... I'm like a walking, talking political cartoon.
So what did you look for in Clinton's voice when you started doing him?
Raspy, real raspy. I didn't know how I was going to be able to do him.
You know, how did you do it? You didn't have to, like, hurt your voice to do it, did you?
No. You see, I worry a lot about how I'm going to do a voice, but I should know by now that I should just relax and, you know, do all this passive, you know, watching on videotape and watching their speeches. And there's only so much of these guys I can take, so that can become grueling after a while. And then eventually something happens where from the inside out, you know, I sort of understand the character more, and I've captured the essence, you know. I mean, it comes from the inside. I don't have to worry about how to do the voice. I can just feel the character and it'll happen. And, you know, after a while, I'm not quite at that point right now. After a while, I've built up enough of a vocabulary, enough topics, you know, I know how the president feels about this issue and that issue and that issue, where I can stand up in front of an audience and just take questions, because that's what I like to do with my presidents. I did it with Reagan, did it with Bush, where I hold a press conference where people can come in and ask questions, and it's very cathartic for them and for me, because, you know, most of us never get to question the president, and it takes on a certain theatricality, you know. I mean, people forget that I'm just an actor playing the president, and Sometimes it can get really frightening. People yelling at me, what are you going to do about AIDS? And I give some evasive answer, and then they yell back, and they're really serious. They forget. And then we all have that moment where we sort of laugh and realize, oh, wow, it got out of hand there.
You're lucky you can go home at night and not take responsibility for this.
I don't have the responsibility to run the country.
Let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. My guest is political satirist Jim Morris. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Political satirist Jim Morris is my guest. How did you start to realize that you could do impressions of other people?
Well, I was probably around the dinner table when I was a kid, of course. My uncles and my aunts and... I remember sitting across from my Uncle Morty and
could you pass the matzo balls already? I'm sitting here waiting for the matzo balls. Look at the kid there. He's sitting there looking at me. What's he doing?
He's mimicking you already. Would you ignore him?
What?
Ignore him. He's mimicking you.
He's mimicking me? Young man, why are you talking like that?
I just looked at him. I said,
I don't know. Why are you talking like that?
You know, it was fascinating to me. So it.
Now, who had a who takes it better, presidents or uncles, when you do them?
Well, I didn't get too much encouragement when I was a kid, the teachers in school. There were always a few who did encourage me. Well, I remember one teacher allowed me 5 minutes of class time every day, if I wanted it, to stand up at the very beginning of the class and get it out of my system and. Everybody, you know, because otherwise I'd be a disruptive. That was bargaining. I mean, that was quite a bargain. I got 5 minutes at the top of the class. I don't know whether it's once a week or every day to get it out of my system and imitate all the other teachers. And he'd stand in the back and just really dig it. You know, it was and the principal of the school. One time I actually went on the because I was president of my class. I actually in my senior year went on the public address system. I had access to it, you see, and I knew how to get through the whole complex there. And I went on as the principal and dismissed the whole school early.
Did they go?
Well, let's put it this way. Everybody else left a lot earlier than I did that day.
What would you do with your 5 minutes in front of the class?
Well, I would imitate the other teachers and improvise and make things up and have teachers talking to each other and really, I didn't get dirty or anything like that, but, you know, I used to do these little sketches where the French teacher would arrive on a motorcycle and I'd make the sound effects and, you know, I can't remember most of it.
Jim, can you tell us how you got down the voice of President Bush?
Well, I suppose it was a cross between John Wayne and Mr. Rogers and Liberace. Yeah, it was.
The Liberace part makes it really interesting.
Yeah,
I start out with this John Wayne type thing, and who else did I mention? Mr. Rogers, John Wayne, and you're special. Do you know that? And then the real, you know, John Wayne and Liberace and Mr. Rogers. You know, my fellow Americans, you are special. You know that? You know, it's sort of like that. But Bush, just watching him is was enough for me. I mean, the broken syntax and, we have a new world order out there. There's a new breeze blowing. And we're breaking new ground. What was I saying?
What about Ronald Reagan? What'd you look for in his voice and in his manner of speaking?
Oh, these are difficult questions. It's so hard to say. I mean, it's like you can't really put your finger on it. It's almost like I can't describe how I get a voice, especially someone like Reagan. Grandfatherly, a little vacant and lost, and no, I cannot describe it. It's because that's not what I start with. It's just.
What do you start with?
I start with the watching him and a feeling of his attitudes. Basically, it's attitudes and emotions. That's what really makes it fly.
Reagan's emotions when he's trying to charm a group or a person or the camera, especially. He's learned a lot, you know, over his career and how to do that. But the eyebrows arched and the lips perched and the glint in his eye and
you know, that little chuckle there and the head bobbing around. And
so you're wondering what he's going to say, and you know that he likes you, and he's a very endearing guy. You're waiting to hear what he has to say. And then when he talks about patriotic virtue and all that, and you're thinking, me? He's talking to me. You are an American hero. Your deeds have kindled the flame that burns deep in our souls and provides endless inspiration to all those that you touch. Me? In my day-to-day life? Yes, you. You've carried the torch and held it high for all to see, for all who yearn to see our shores from sea to... And you want to help him out. It's a shining sea, Mr. President.
Right, over there. For all you have done and... all you continue to do, well, for all you do, this budge for you. I don't know. I just get the script. I stand on my mark and I say, what's my motivation? To please Nancy, that's it.
Now, how do you feel when you see Dana Carvey doing Bush or Phil Hartman doing Clinton? Are you critical of their impersonations?
Well, it's hard for me not to be critical. But I keep it to myself. I mean, I say, oh, yeah, they get the essence of his thing there, and they miss there. Everything is true. I mean, if they do their homework and they have their rendition, then that is as true as what I present. But the real answer is I can't watch them because it throws me off. I have to go right to the source. And if I watch Hartman do his thing, then mine is going to be a little slanted or colored. It gets more difficult when you consider that so many millions more people see and identify with their impressions of the president than mine. So a lot of times people will think that I'm going to come out with a wouldn't be prudent. And I don't do that in my act. But I'm not offended when they say, oh, you're the guy who does, wouldn't be prudent, right? No, not right. I can understand. I mean, they have a lot more exposure than I do. But for Clinton, I just have to go right to the source. And, we're talking about change, a change for new ideas, a change for new ideas and a new generation of leadership and a break from the past and the old ideas and the old generation of leadership for a change into the new generation of leadership and new ideas. What did you say? I don't know, but it sounded pretty good, I think.
Political satirist Jim Morris. This Friday, he performs at Symphony Space in New York as part of the Toyota Comedy Festival. June 17th, he opens at Catch a Rising Star in Boston.